Welcome to Caring on the Go, your exclusive access to the latest news and commentary from the current issue of Caring for the Ages, the official newspaper of AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Statements made by guests on this podcast are their own opinions and are not necessarily the positions of the Society. A speaker's appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them, their views, or any entity they represent. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now here's our host of Caring on the Go, Dr. Carl Steinberg.
Hello, and welcome to Caring on the Go for our April 2024 issue. And I know many of us are still on a little bit of a high from the AMDA annual meeting in San Antonio in March. I'm your host and editor-in-chief emeritus of Caring for the Ages, Dr. Carl Steinberg. Caring on the Go, a member of the AMDA on the Go podcast series, spotlights articles and stories from Caring for the Ages, the news magazine from AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. With every new issue, we feature Caring for the Ages editor-in-chief, Dr. Elizabeth Gallick, to discuss some key articles in this episode highlighting our April issue of Caring. Dr. Gallick is a nurse practitioner in long-term care and community-based settings through a clinical practice within the Shepherd Pratt Health System. She's a professor at the University of Maryland School of Nursing, where she teaches in the Adult Gerontology Primary Care Nurse Practitioner Program. And Beth also conducts research to improve care practices for older adults with dementia and their caregivers in long-term care. And I'm also proud to report to our listeners that Beth was elected by the AMDA House of Delegates to serve as one of their representatives on the organization's board of directors. So Beth, congrats on your election to the board, and I hope you'll enjoy it as much as I did when I was on that board.
Thank you so much, Carl. And I'm really looking forward to serving on the board. I've been a member of AMDA since, I think, 2005. And so I have a lot of time and energy invested and have always enjoyed my membership. So I look forward to it.
Well, your leadership is very much appreciated. And today we're also honored to be welcoming not one, but two additional guests to Caring on the Go. First, we're also glad to welcome Glenn Tillotson, PhD, FIDSA, FCCCP. Glenn is a microbiologist who co-authored an article on C. diff in this issue. Dr. Tillotson has over 40 years global infectious disease experience in drug development and global medical education. His primary qualifications were in microbiology and biochemistry, while his clinical training was at the University of Manchester, where he studied microbiological links to inflammatory bowel disease. Glenn has published on many aspects of infectious disease, over 200 papers on PubMed. He's written several book chapters and edited an ebook on Clostridium or Clostridioides difficile, or whatever it was called when the book was published. And he's also the editor-in-chief of Expert Reviews in Anti-Infective Therapy. Glenn's current work has involved developing novel approaches to the treatment of Clostridium difficile infections with live biotherapeutic products. Also, welcome to my friend and colleague, another AMDA board member and House of Delegates rep, Allison Villegas, PAC, who is the recipient of this year's Coles Award for the most influential article published in Caring in the year 2023. Allison has been a physician assistant working in the post-acute long-term care setting for the last 12 years. She graduated from the University of Colorado Child Health Associate Physician Assistant Program. In addition to serving on the AMDA board as a House Delegates rep, Allison also serves on the board of directors for her state AMDA chapter, CMDA, the Colorado Society for Post-Acute Long-Term Care Medicine. So to Drs. Gallick and Tillotson and Ms. Villegas, welcome to Caring on the Go.
Thanks, Carl.
Great. Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Indeed. Thank you.
All right. So we're going to kick off today's session talking about the lead article from page one of the April issue of Caring by our senior reporter, Joanne Caldy, on a topic near and dear to my heart entitled Pet Presence in Long-Term Care, Making It Happen in Your Community. And in fact, I have to say I'm a little disappointed that Joanne didn't hit me up for this article, considering one of my claims to fame is that I've taken my dogs to work in nursing homes for the last 29 years. But hopefully some of our listeners are aware of my dogs and have met them over the years. But Some of our listeners will also probably remember the Caring Canines calendars that we used to produce annually for the benefit of the foundation, which Joanne also was really involved in. But in any event, those of us who've witnessed the profound impact that animals can have on nursing home residents can attest to what a gift it can be. So Beth, what did you get out of this article, beyond the adorable photos it included that I recommend to everyone?
Thanks, Carl, for mentioning those photos. Joanne was able to get several of them, and there's some very interesting animals that you might not anticipate. So if you haven't looked already, please go and check it out. So I think Joanne really summarized 4 points nicely. One, if a family member is moving into a post-acute and long-term care settings, some communities will let you bring a pet with you, as long as there's often size restrictions, as long as that individual is able to care for their furry friend. But that, in many instances, may not be realistic unless perhaps you're moving into an independent living setting. So as you age, talk to your family and friends about who could care for your pet. And also bring your pet to visit if you were unable to care for it. Some communities have their own pet or pets, and often the activity or recreation department takes the lead in helping to care and manage that pet, often with some help from nursing, housekeeping, and in some instances, other residents. And then Carl, as you mentioned, pet visits, especially when staff bring their pets in with them, is often probably the best model for sustainability in post-acute and long-term care settings. It really is a win-win for the residents, for the staff, as well as for the staff who are bringing their pet in, because they get to have their good furry friend with them for a day, or at least a couple of hours.
Yeah. Well, so for our listeners, anyone who has a pet they think would respond well to post-acute long-term care settings, I encourage you to consider taking them in. Just make sure you do it on a day you're not in a rush, because it can definitely slow things down. You know, you can't really walk down the hall and somebody in a room's like, oh, a dog. You know, you can't just walk on by, right? That ain't right. So, all right, so our next article is going to be a clinical piece on C. diff from Below the Fold on page 1 by Drs. Jim Lett, Cyril Warren, and Dr. Tillotson. So, Glenn, one thing some of our listeners may not be aware of is that what we've referred to as Clostridium difficile for decades has now had a change in nomenclature to Clostridioides difficile. So as a microbiologist, can you tell us what's up with that?
Taxonomy is now governed by very specific methods, generally called omics. And the most popular one we know about is metabolomics, which is where we're able to analyze the various chemicals that are processed through bacteria, and they sometimes help our bodies and sometimes they don't. So we have all these new tools, and we've actually shown some quite interesting differences between Clostridia, a good one to quote would be Clostridia perfringens, I'm sure everybody is aware of, and formerly Clostridium difficile. There are changes at this molecular level. So the taxonomists, in their wisdom and in their quiet little laboratories, came up with the word Clostridioides. But as C. diff, as we all call it, has been around since 1935, it's going to be hard for most of us to actually change. Even I have to think it's a Clostridioides difficile. But it's important to remember that C. diff, which is still a convenient term, is still a major infection affecting, in this country, about 500,000 people, and about 30,000 of them will die. So whether it's Clostridium difficile, Clostridioides, or C. diff, it's still the same bug and still does the same damage.
Right. Well, that's interesting and good to know that. And yeah, it's hard for me too, but at least we can still refer to it as C. diff, and we won't be wrong in calling it that. So probably most of our listeners and readers are aware that metronidazole is no longer considered first line therapy for C. diff, and probably also aware that using fecal matter, or fecal type stuff as a therapeutic agent is something that we actually have available to us these days. And, you know, I remember when I first heard about that many years ago, I think it came out of Europe, right? With a combination of awe and disgust, right? It seems like it's quite effective and, you know, especially for treatment resistant cases. So, Glenn, what are the most important points you wanted to get across in authoring this article?
The 4th century, who actually first started using, he called it yellow soup. And that was basically fluid feces that were from healthy people, and he gave it to people with diarrheal conditions, and it worked.
Wow.
Unfortunately, it took a long time for the rest of us to catch up. And you're quite right. It can be regarded as something with a touch of awe, but disgust as well. But nevertheless, I think progress has been made in terms of guidance from the FDA, who said that home-brewed fecal transplants really don't cut it. It's not good clinical practice. So they have helped with the companies with developing things called live biotherapeutic products, which are ostensibly the same as a fecal transplant, except they're screened for pathogens, and the FDA have a nice list of 29 at the moment, and it actually includes monkeypox, and the companies have to really thoroughly screen the products, and they screen the donors to make sure they're not giving anything untoward to the patients. So FMT, or more specifically, live biotherapeutic products, I think are going to be very useful in that the data from the clinical trials have shown that products like Rebiota work in terms of reducing the recurrence of the disease. Now, many of your listeners will be aware that C. diff is the gift that keeps on giving. You know, you get C. diff, and a quarter of you will get it again. And of those, up to 60% will get it again. And that's why we need to restore the normal gut flora, which is damaged in the process of getting C. diff. And that's where the fecal transplant comes in. You actually make the gut whole again. And using live biotherapeutics, that is done safely and effectively. As I said, there are two products. One is given rectally, Rebiota. The other is given orally, but it's on a after a bowel prep, and it's 4 capsules a day for 3 days. So there's differences in how they're given, but in principle, you're restoring the gut flora. That should theoretically, and more often than not does, reduce the cycle of recurrence, because that is what can be particularly debilitating in the older patients. And in some of the studies I've done, I've actually seen patients have more than 10 episodes of C. diff in a year. So it really can be a really problematic disease. So I think the points about FMT, or better still, LBPs, is that you are, in a positive way, restoring the right environment. And from that point, then, the patients will start to feel better, because there's a relationship between C. diff and mental quality of life. And that, you know, by getting the right bugs back in place, then hopefully patients will avoid the infection and begin to feel better.
Yeah, so now we have another acronym of LBP, which probably most of us think of low back pain, but now we've got another one to keep in mind if we read that somewhere. And there's no questions. I'm sure our listeners who are clinicians, I mean, C. diff can be a really devastating condition, and it's good to have more tools in our armamentarium for sure. Beth, anything else you found especially important from this great clinical article, or any questions for Dr. Tillotson?
Yes. Thank you, Glenn. It really was a great article, and I'm sure the readers will enjoy it and are actually probably already enjoying it. So if you could share with us, for a practitioner who may not have ordered fecal microbiota transplantation or considered it for their patient, is there any any contraindications? And how would a practitioner kind of get that started or make a referral?
Right. In terms of contraindications, there are certain GI conditions that we don't know what the interaction can be. So I'm going to say things like inflammatory bowel disease. We don't really know what goes on there because of those patients were not studied. I think they are being studied currently with the trials. So apart from that, I feel fairly confident that most patients would not have any significant contraindications. And in fact, I was involved in looking at patients who had multiple comorbidities. So if you're looking for contraindication, those are the types of patients that you would see problems. And in fact, they responded exactly the same as patients who had no comorbidities. So in terms of contraindications, I think that's less of a worry in my book. In terms of access to the products, usually a consultant pharmacist accesses the products directly to the company. So in the case of Rebiota, you would contact Ferring. In the case of Viost, which is the one that's taken for 3 days, you would contact Seres. They actually have their own pharmacy department set up so that they can organize the distribution of the product to your pharmacy. Because there are certain specific storage conditions that are required at the pharmacy side. But once you've ordered it, then it's relatively very easy to give the single dose one. And the bit about the payment is the thing that I shy away from because that's not my specialty area. But I do know that there are ways to pay for the product which does not impact the nursing home, Nottingham's bottom line, I guess is the term. But certainly access is straightforward, and I believe payment and reimbursement is also straightforward now as well.
Thank you, Glenn. I'm sure that will help our listeners.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Glenn. And thanks for your ongoing work in this area. It's really an important clinical topic. And I hope our readers will enjoy your article. And I think I'm not an expert on payment or any of that either, but I think if I'm not mistaken, these products are quite pricey, right? They're probably more pricey than fidaxomicin. Any idea on that, Glenn?
Yes. Fidaxomicin seems to be around $4,500, of course. Rebiota is $9,000, but Viost is $17,500. But just to put that into perspective, a patient with C. diff will cost you around $26,000 to $28,000 to treat them. But if you use a product like Rebiota or Viost, then you can reduce the recurrence rate, and therefore the difference is quite significantly reduced by using an LBP. And in fact, within my article, I spoke briefly about the financial problems of having C. diff in the nursing home. So it'd be good to refer to that. And then just try to put into balance that the excess cost of having C. diff versus the cost of using an effective product.
Yeah, that's a good perspective to keep in mind. And I mean, certainly a couple of days in the ICU or something like that, you're way above that already. So great. Well, thanks. Thanks for that guidance on what is still a serious and widespread problem in our care setting. So let's see, Beth, next we're going to talk about your Caring Collaborative column on page 3, titled Advocating for an Aging Relative During a Skilled Nursing Facility Stay. Managing opportunities and challenges. And Beth, I want to thank you again for sharing another deeply personal piece about your own family's journey, building on your column from last month. And I hope you know that your story resonates with me, and I'm sure with many of our readers and listeners. One thing my family and I learned over years of caring for my mom when she was in and out of the hospital and nursing homes in her last years of life was something you point out in your article, and I think a really critical point is that idea of maintaining a physical presence with your loved one when they're institutionalized to the extent you can. You know, in the hospital, we would strive to keep someone there 24/7, and I know if we hadn't, there were multiple occasions where there were significant errors that we caught, and she would have died years sooner if we hadn't had that presence. And not everyone has the privilege and resources to be able to do that, but I really do think physically being at your loved one's side has immeasurable value for multiple reasons. And anyway, if you can just please tell our listeners a little bit more about your family's experience and the lessons that you learned that might be of value to our listeners.
Thanks, Carl. So my mother had a fall and a hip fracture and went to the hospital, had a few complications after surgery and had a 9-day admission, and then went for a skilled nursing facility stay. And the advice I'm giving is kind of based on this experience as well as my knowledge as a practitioner in the setting. We know that most individuals select a SNF for a rehabilitation stay based on geographic proximity. And possibly online quality ratings. Some families may look at those. And they're two important factors, but they generally don't tell the whole story. So if it's possible, and I know it's so hard while you're trying to be in the hospital and manage family and work obligations, but if it's possible, narrowing it down to maybe two places and going for having one family member go for a visit would probably be helpful. And now post-COVID, we're finding that some facilities, I know in Maryland, it's very prominent in this state, there's a wide use of agency staff rather than regular staff. And so that's something you can ask about, because the agency staff could be quite skilled. Unfortunately, they may not know or be as fully aware of the policies and procedures and practices within that facility. And they may be working in several facilities, and so there may be a lack of consistency. If you can, visit the rehabilitation suite and ask the facility leadership what the policy is in the facility about staff assisting residents or patients to stand or a lift. Because some facilities now are using what they call a no lift policy, and that's not allowing what's being practiced in with their PT and OT to transfer back to the nursing staff, and instead Hoyer lifts are being used if the patient needs help. After admission, make sure you share information with your family member about your family member with the interdisciplinary team. Things like ideas about their baseline in cognition, physical function, and behavior, as well as some personal preferences. And you're, as a family member, you're probably best suited to suggest some ways that the staff can motivate your family member to engage in rehabilitation and care activities. Also, partner with the rehabilitation team about goals of care. Find out if there's exercises that you can do outside of the rehabilitation sessions. And then lastly, because of all the multiple transfers that happen, either from home to hospital to SNF, ask to see a copy of your family member's medication list after they've been admitted, because with those multiple transitions, sometimes there can be some unintended errors. And it's always good to be on top of that. And if you have challenges, even though it's an emotional issue, try to keep your advocacy focused on facts. Try to work it out at the unit level first. If that doesn't work, you can always move up through the chain of command and document things either in email or in writing if you're not finding that you're seeing a solution to some of the challenges.
Wow, that is a lot of real excellent practical tips, and thank you for that. And I really encourage our readers to refer to that, because if you haven't had a loved one, in that situation, sooner or later you will, right? So
yeah.
I really appreciate you sharing that meaningful perspective. I hope your mom's doing a lot better now, and she's truly blessed to have you advocating for her.
Thank you, Carl. I was going to just share briefly that she is doing much better. She's in a new location at a small assisted living, and it seems to be a very good fit for her. And so we're very fortunate. And I'm hoping to write a little article about some of the in defense of smaller facilities and when they're appropriate.
That's great. And I have to echo that. I think, for me, a little six bed where you're getting home cooked food and, just like living in a house and it's, two caregivers for six residents. In some ways, it's a lot better than some of these big places. But it's, obviously, we want to do person-centered care. But I do share that a little bit of a bias in favor of those little places. So, all right. Well, we're going to wrap up by discussing an article from page 6 of the April issue by our managing editor, Dr. Tess Bird. And this piece is about the 2024 Coles Award recipient, Allison Villegas, PAC, our guest today. And this one's entitled, Advanced Practice Providers Take Center Stage with the 2023 Coles Award. So this award is named after Tess's predecessor as Caring's managing editor, Terry Coles, with whom I had the privilege of working for years when I was editor-in-chief of Caring. And this award recognizes the most highly downloaded article of the year. So the original 2023 article, Clearing Up Misconceptions About Nurse Practitioners and PAs in Long-Term Care, was downloaded over 1,000 times last year. And I can say that I've worked closely with several advanced practice practitioners in post-acute and long-term care over the years, including my now retired PA colleague, Barbara Ruderman, and I would have gladly entrusted the care of my own family members to her. In fact, I did. So considering the challenges that we have getting competent practitioners into our care setting, I'd say from my experience and talking to people all over the country that their presence is essential. So Allison, first of all, congrats on winning the award. That's really cool.
Great. Thank you so much. Yeah, it's such an honor. And, everyone who helped collaborate on the article, we're thrilled that the information is being accessed so rapidly, so highly.
Yeah. So can you please remind our listeners about the subject and contents of that original article? And we're going to try to include a link to it on our website when we post this podcast for people who want to refer back to it.
Oh, yeah, that would be great. The article looks at three common misconceptions about APPs, looking at initial admission assessment and what we can and cannot do there, malpractice risk, and patient satisfaction.
All right. And so what are the sort of take-home messages that you'd say about this article?
Oh, yeah. Of course. So the initial admission assessment really breaks down that we can't use the initial billing codes for admission into the nursing home. So we can do what we call kind of tuck-in visits or transition of care visits, where we can see the new patient before, the attending physician is able to, if there's an acute issue going on, look at medication reconciliation, or if they're having a CHF exacerbation, or maybe there's a urinary tract infection or a cellulitis. And so your APP colleagues can look at and see those patients before the physician is there if needed to kind of get the care started in a more timely manner. And then practice risk. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to go on to talk about the malpractice risk. It just looks at some studies that break down the risk of malpractice lawsuits between NPs and PAs compared to our physician colleagues.
Right. So one thing is that since the physician doesn't really have to do the initial comprehensive exam for 30 days, it's very possible that an advanced practice practitioner can get there. For as sick as people are coming out of the hospital, let's hope that nobody's waiting 30 days to do an initial visit. So that's definitely one really important function. So Tess wrote this article in our current issue about your piece and the Coles Award, and it said that you felt a little guilty, if I'm reading it properly, that because it was kind of a joint effort of AMDA's NPPA Advisory Council. And I'll just say that council has done great work. You should totally share the glory with them. And thanks to the council for all that they've achieved. Beth, anything you want to ask Allison or any observations about either the original article or this one or the award?
Yes. So while others were involved, Allison, I just want to say Allison did do the lion's share of the writing for this article. So the other thing that I'd like her to share is some of the kind of new and exciting things that are going on for NPs and PAs within the society. Allison, if you could share some of that with us as well.
Yeah, no, this is a great opportunity to focus on that, because as we all know, we have our new website that looks amazing. So thank you to our AMDA and PulpMed / staff. But we are going to have a APP or NPPA network community on there. And so that'll be a nice place where APPs can get together, ask questions, share stories, offer each other support. So we'll have a nice location on our online intranet, or what would we call that? On our online presence for us, the NPs and PAs in our space, to get together and kind of lean on each other and ask questions.
And I can share that the word has kind of gone out on that network, trying to recruit NPs and PAs to be active in the society and to apply for membership to committees. So we're already putting it to good use.
Yeah. Thank you, Beth.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And for our listeners, please do log on and then sign up. Well, we really need willing volunteers, and we appreciate, I mean, there's really, it's kind of a grassroots effort that makes things happen within the organization. I don't know how much it's been publicized. There's probably going to be a big rollout at some point, but the name of the organization was changed at the meeting, and you kind of mentioned it, Allison, but it's no longer going to have the word AMDA in it. It's just going to be the Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medical Society, or PULTMED. So anyway, well, that's great, Allison. Congratulations again on the Coles Award, and thank you also for your work on the AMDA board. Please keep it up. We appreciate you.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
All right. So as usual, there was so much additional great content in this issue, including a wonderful and heartfelt DEI column by Dr. Cheryl Huckins on page 4, and then Associate Editor Dr. Jerry Winokur's piece about Medicare Advantage on page 5. And a piece about a favorite topic of mine, the importance of goals of care conversations in our post-acute and long-term care population, with some practical tips from the Institute for Healthcare Improvement to empower all staff to feel comfortable with these conversations, written by Carolyn Kasdan, and that starts on page 15. Dr. Gallick, before we close, do you have any final comments or wisdom to share on these or other articles from the issue?
Sure. I'd also encourage people to check out Rob Aceta's column. He's a pharmacist on pharmacogenomics, a personalized approach to improving long-term care outcomes. And this issue is really chock full of pictures. We were so fortunate with all the pet pictures and photos from the meeting. So we have a lot of photos about the Futures program from the conference. And you can see all of what they were engaged with. And we're fortunate to have such a wonderful group of Futures who participated this year. So check it out.
Great. All right. Well, that's going to wrap it up for the April 2024 Caring on the Go podcast. Beth, Glenn, Allison, thank you for sharing your wisdom and expertise with our listeners today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And thanks as always, Carl. You do a great job as host.
All right, I'll pay you later. So, okay, under the leadership of Editor-in-Chief, Dr. Elizabeth Gallick, Associate Editor, Dr. Jerry Winokur, and Managing Editor, Dr. Tess Bird, Caring for the Ages continues to report and highlight the outstanding work being done by the Post-Acute Long-Term Care Medical Society and its leaders, members, and communities. Please take a look at this jam-packed 20-page April issue of 2024, available, as always, without a paywall at www.caringfortheages.com. And please recommend it. Share caring with your friends and colleagues. Meanwhile, thanks to our listeners for your support and for the wonderful work you do every day. And it was a treat to see many of our listeners and readers, along with Caring's editorial advisory board, at our annual meeting in San Antonio just in March. And an upcoming issue of Caring will focus on the annual meeting, so keep your eyes open for that, especially those of you that weren't able to make it. And please let us know what you like about our podcast and our news magazine, and also what you think we could do better. So now, until next time, I'm Dr. Carl Steinberg for Caring on the Go.
If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, visit paltc.org/podcast.